The following program was funded by the Annenberg CPB Project. Sound Studies in American History. The topic of this program is the cultural clash between the newly arrived English and the Native Americans at Jamestown Colony. The title of this sound study is As It Was in the Beginning.
The year 1607, late December, bitter cold in the land called Senecomica. Warm enough here, however, inside the largest dwelling in the town of Werowocomoco. Warmth from an open fire that provides the only light. Body warmth from the considerable crowd squeezed into this smoky, shadowy interior. Men, women, even some children, all come to see the prisoner, a short, stocky man with a bushy beard, who stands now before the one whom they call father, the lord of this house, this town, this union of kingdoms called Senecomica. Their ruler, you might say their emperor, Powhatan.
Upon a platform like a bed, he sat covered with a great robe made of raccoon skins, and all the tails hanging by.
From an account written by one of the prisoner's countrymen.
On either hand did sit a young wench of 16 or 18 years, and along on each side the house two rows of men. And behind them as many women, with all their heads and shoulders painted red, many of their heads bedecked with the white down of birds, and a great chain of white beads about their necks.
The emperor gravely and majestically greeted the prisoner and ordered great platters of food to be set before him.
The queen of Appomattox was appointed to bring the prisoner water to wash his hands, and another brought him a bunch of feathers instead of a towel to dry them.
Rather gracious treatment for one who was at best a trespasser, and at worst an invader. One of those who had established themselves downriver, back in the springtime, with never so much as a may I, and never giving a straight answer when asked about their intentions. Well, now, one of them had been captured, and we'd soon enough see how Powhatan and the elders dealt with such intruders.
Having feasted him after their best manner, a long consultation was held, and the conclusion was two great stones were brought before Powhatan. Then as many as could laid hands on the captain, dragged him to the stones, and laid his head thereon. Two stood over him, being ready with their clubs to beat out his brains.
What's this? A young girl comes running out of the crowd, kneels beside the prisoner.
The emperor's dearest daughter, Pocahontas, laid her own head upon his to save him from death. Whereat the emperor was contented that Captain John Smith should live.
Captain John Smith meets Powhatan and Pocahontas in the forest primeval. Is this an appropriate starting place for programs on the origin and growth of the United States? Of course, we might have begun at other points, with the first immigrants to North America. Maybe those Asians who crossed the land bridge of the Bering Strait some 15,000 years earlier, if we knew more about them. Or with the achievements of the Hopis and the Zunis in the Southwest, the mound builder culture in the Ohio River Valley, the Mississippian culture. We might have begun with the Spanish Jesuits who founded a mission in the land called Senecomica and were wiped out by Powhatan's people, who then suffered revenge at the hands of the Spanish. Or with Powhatan himself, how he garnered a domain of some 9,000 miles and some 12 to 15,000 Algonquin tribespeople. It was only after all that and more, after thousands of years of human activity in the forest primeval, that Englishmen began to look with covetous eye toward the land around Chesapeake Bay, the land they called Virginia. Promotional ballads and broadsides trumpeted the promise of Virginia, stirring hopes for gold and other precious metals, hopes for a valuable trade with the natives, hopes for relieving England's overpopulation and its dependency on others for needed commodities, hopes for countering the spread of Spanish power in the New World, and hopes that Englishmen might sow what was spiritual and reap what was temporal. Not all the English were impressed.
The colonizers belonged to one partisan group within England,
as explained by historian Anthony Francis Jennings.
And there were plenty of other people who were quite opposed to the notion of going out there. And there were quite a few people who held to precepts of Christian morality, and they didn't like this notion of going out and conquering.
Confronted with divided public opinion, the British Crown left colonization to private enterprise. The 104 English men and boys who established a beachhead on the shores of Chesapeake Bay in May of that year, 1607, Captain John Smith among them, were investors and employees of the Virginia Company, Incorporated, of London. Their mission, as interpreted by Professor Jennings.
There was an ostensible reason, and there were what I think of as real reasons. The ostensible reason was to convert the heathen to Christianity. That served as very good cover for the real reason, which was to get rich quick and to acquire a lot of land.
A more moderate view from another historian, Professor J. Frederick Fowes.
Well, they were there to make bucks, but now, don't get me wrong, the English mentality was of course very ethnocentric. They believed, truly believed, that they had the right way of living and worshiping. Their goal was to show that Protestants could do a better job, a more humane job, of colonizing than the Spanish Catholics did. So that if the Indians would recognize that the English had a better way and to accept these so-called cultural presents that the English were bringing them, Christianity, English clothing, language, lifestyle, and so forth, then in fact both peoples could share a common ideology and a common future, if you will.
I think it was very consciously determined by some very hard-headed gents that this made a fine excuse for doing what would otherwise be quite denounced as immoral and reprehensible. But because it was going to be saving the souls of all these poor innocent savages, they were not only able to present it in a good light, but actually to make a number of very sincere Christians in England pay for the thing.
Powhatan's people, as they observed the goings-on at Jamestown, could hardly have concluded that English culture was superior to their own.
Our men were destroyed with cruel diseases, with swellings, flies, burning fever, but for the most part they died of mere famine.
According to George Percy, at various times president of the Jamestown Council.
There were never Englishmen left in a foreign country in such misery as we were in this newly discovered Virginia.
The initial groups of colonists that came over beginning in 1607 consisted of a overly large percentage of gentlemen, people that came over to protect their own or in some cases their families' large investments in the Virginia Company. And these people came over not intending to work.
Professor Fowles.
It was a hodgepodge, the early colonists, sailors, mariners, traders, soldiers of fortune like Captain John Smith, gentlemen who didn't know how to survive in this North American so-called wilderness.
Captain John Smith was on a desperate mission when, in December of 1607, he was captured and carried to Powhatan. The number at Jamestown had been reduced to half or less its original 104. He hoped to trade with the Indians for food to sustain the remainder through the winter.
And the emperor's dearest daughter, Pocahontas, laid her own head upon his to save Captain John Smith from death.
Fear not, John Smith, for you see that now we are friends, and within 4 days you shall have your liberty.
Based on John Smith's account of exchanges with Powhatan.
Perhaps you will settle our minds about the cause of your coming hither, you and your people.
Yes, well,
being in a fight with the Spaniards, who are our enemy, and nearly put a retreat, we came into this shore.
The Spaniards? Ah, yes, they are our enemy also.
John Smith is under orders from the company. Establish trade before the natives know you mean to settle here. Unknowingly, he has given the right answer to Poatan. He went on with his story.
And our ship being leaky, we were forced to stay to mend her.
After much conversation, with assurances of shared concerns and mutual friendship, Poatan offered to give John Smith a country named Kapahausik, where he and his people might live free of fear. Then he told him to return to Jamestown and send back two cannon and a grindstone.
And for the hatchets and copper you provide us, we will supply corn, venison, whatever is needed to feed you.
Good.
And you, John Smith, you I shall forever esteem as my son.
After that, every few days, Pocahontas and her attendants appeared at Jamestown with ample supplies of food for all. And the question is, why? Why did Powhatan's people allow and even help the English to survive? Professor Jennings.
One of the reasons they made that mistake was that they were so eager to acquire the products of European manufacture. Nobody has ever questioned the fact that a steel hatchet operates better than a stone one. There's no question that a copper kettle is more portable than a hollowed-out rock for boiling food. But in order to get them in trade, they had to be on friendly terms with the people who made them.
And Professor Fowles.
Poatan regarded this pitiful band of 104 English men and boys that first landed at Jamestown as no real threat to him. They were too weak to do anything against him. But they had that technology, the large ships, the cannon, the muskets, the armor, that perhaps if Poatan could dominate them, or he could treat them as another subject tribe in his domain, that he would be even stronger against his native enemies. They did have enemies. So the thesis that the Poatan allowed the English to live and prosper in the early years, based on his need for a new ally, an ally that had now for the first time powerful European muskets, is perhaps an accurate one.
And so, from our 20th century vantage point, we can see the apparent rescue of John Smith by Pocahontas as a ritualistic act-out, part of a larger strategy. Poatan's attempt to absorb these Englishmen into his own domain, his family, to share his culture with them in return for their manufactured products and their alliance against his enemies. The English, with the possible exception of John Smith, missed this point entirely. They concluded that God, their God, had moved Pocahontas and softened her father's heart toward John Smith. They even became jealous and suspicious of Smith. How come he was so favored? Was he about to run off and take his place among the Indians? Live like a lord, draped in furs and strings of pearls? And then where would the rest of them be? So, within weeks, they had concocted a ritualistic act-out of their own to assure continuing help from the Indians by making Poatan a subject lord of King James I of England.
The presents were sent by water, which is near 100 miles, and the captain, Smith, and Newport among them, went by land.
January 1608. Under snow-laden loblolly pines at Werowocomoco, Poatan and his attendants, fur-mantled against the cold, bird-wing headdresses stirring in the wind, meet the Jamestown party. Poatan is about to receive a boatload of presents from King James I.
The presents were brought to him, his basin and pitcher, bedstead and other furniture set up, his scarlet cloak and apparel, with much ado put on him.
And then the pièce de résistance, a somewhat tawdry copper crown. This is a coronation.
But a foul trouble there was to make Poetan kneel to receive his crown, he neither knowing the majesty nor meaning of a crown, nor bending of the knee. After so many persuasions, examples, instructions, as tired them all, at last, by leaning on his shoulders, they made him to stoop a little, and three, having the crown in their hands, put it on his head. In the name of his majesty, King James asked. At the volley of shot, the king started up in a horrible fear till he saw that all was well. Then, remembering himself to congratulate their kindness, he gave his old shoes and his mantle to Captain Newport.
In the forest primeval, a meeting of two cultures, each having need of the other, each confident of its own superiority to the other, each, therefore, underestimating the other.
This is, I think, representative of the ethnocentrism that ran through both peoples, how they really were missing what we see today as two cultures almost inevitably destined to come to blows, because both sides thought so much of their own traditions.
Captain Smith, some doubt I have of your coming hither that makes me not so kindly inclined to assist you as I would.
The following winter, John Smith again stands before Poetan, who sits regally on his platform, gray hair spread on a beaded leather pillow at his back. His repeated requests for firearms have been ignored. The Indians have stopped supplying food to the English.
Believing your promises to supply my wants, I neglected all, and even sent you men for your building, neglecting my own.
True, the English have neglected to provide for themselves, despite the arrival of another shipload of settlers.
Many do inform me your coming is not for trade, but to invade my people and possess my country. My people dare not come to bring you corn, seeing you and your men are armed.
The vow I made to you of my love, both myself and my men have kept. As for your promise, I find it every day violated by some of your subjects.
If you intend so friendly as you say, send here some of your arms.
No, no.
So that I may believe you.
Poetan has decided to let the English starve. And starve they almost did. Their number now stood at 500. They embarked on a policy of aggression and intimidation, burning canoes and villages and fields. The Indians fought back.
Lieutenant Sycamore and the others were found slain, with their mouths stopped full of bread. This being done, it seemeth, to show what others might expect should they come for bread and relief. It reminded me of Valdavia, a Spanish general in the West Indies who was by the Indians forced to drink up a quantity of gold, while they said unto him, "Now glut thyself with gold, Valdavia." Valdavia had sought for gold as Sycamore did for food.
By the spring of 1610, only 60 settlers remained in Jamestown. Convinced now that they would never build a labor force of these Indians, the Virginia Company recruited new settlers, people who knew how to work, to whom they promised free land at the end of 7 years' labor. 1,200 new immigrants arrived in 1610 and 1611, along with new orders which called for military occupation of the region, for all tribes to pay tribute of corn and labor, for Indians to be kept separate from settlers. It was open warfare with Poetan's people.
I commanded every leader to beset the savage houses that none might escape.
From one of George Percy's reports.
And then we fell in upon them, put some 15 or 16 to the sword, and almost all the rest to flight. My lieutenant brought with him the tribe's queen and her children, and one Indian male prisoner. I caused the Indian's head to be cut off. Then, appointed my soldiers to burn their houses and cut down their cords. After that, we marched with the queen and her children to the boats, where it was agreed to put the children to death, which was effected by throwing them overboard and shooting their brains out in the water. My Lord General seemed to be discontented because the queen was spared. So Captain Davis did take the queen ashore and in the woods put her to the sword.
In 1613, the English captured Pocahontas, and the following year she was married to John Rolfe and converted to Christianity. Powhatan abdicated, leaving rulership to a kinsman, Opechancanough. Professor Faust.
Never was the goal to Christianize the Indians more important than the 8 years after 1614. In that year, Pocahontas emerged as the first convert to Anglicanism, the first convert to English civilization, if you will. She became, I think truly, to the dedicated members of the Virginia Company in London, a symbol that they had achieved something great. At the very least, the religious motive was a terrific way to raise funds in England for colonization in Virginia. The Virginia Company, in a 17th century form of telethons, really passed the hat, and it brought in a ton of money.
The company raised the inducements for settlers, offering 100 acres to anyone who would go to Jamestown. Young women were sent to the colony. Poor and unruly children were sent to serve as apprentices and servants. The first black people were brought to the colony. But the greatest inducement was tobacco, Jamestown's first cash crop and real moneymaker, one that increased the need for more and more land. Tobacco. Good news for the Virginia Company. Bad news for the Indians.
By 1618, they had suffered not only further loss of land and pride and status, but they had also suffered from several seasonal epidemics of an unknown origin, which the English claimed had taken hundreds of Indian lives. But certainly by 1620, 1621, Opechancanough, through negotiation, through, I think, the work of Nematanu, Jack of the Feathers, had brought into line many of the old Powhatan tribes and even some new tribes to join an alliance that was, in fact, by the date of the uprising, stronger even than the old tribal alliances under Powhatan in 1607.
Nematanu, Jack of the Feathers, prophet, leader of a revitalization movement among the Indians, an effort to revive and strengthen the traditions of their own civilization, an effort that coincided with renewed efforts by the English to convert Indians, especially Indian youth, to the traditions of English civilization. Early in March 1622, this prophet, this hope, this Jack of the Feathers died, murdered by Englishmen. Some 2 weeks later, on March 22nd.
On that fatal Friday morning, as at other times, the savages came unarmed into our fields, houses, with deer, turkeys, fish, fruits, and other provisions to sell us.
Captain John Smith describes what happened at plantations and settlements now scattered all along the James River.
Yea, in some places they sat down at breakfast with our people. People whom immediately, with their own tools, they slew most barbarously, not sparing either age or sex, man, woman, or child. So sudden in their execution that few or none discerned the weapon or blow that brought them to destruction. And by this means fell that fatal morning 347 men, women, and children.
Root them out from being any longer a people, a cursed nation.
Call it, as the English did, a massacre. The infamous massacre of 1622.
Pursue and follow them. Surprise them in their habitations.
Call it the desperate act of a dying culture.
Burn their towns, demolish their temples, carry away their corn.
Call it a clash of cultures.
deprive them of whatsoever may yield them succor or relief.
Whatever it's called, it precipitated a devastating 10-year war against the Indians. And later, in 1669, it was found by a census that only 7 of the 28 tribes described by John Smith and only 2,000 Indians remained in Virginia. Virginia, England's first permanent New World colony. An appropriate starting place for our study? Its theme recurs again and again in the story of the origin and growth of this nation. A nation in which the world's peoples and cultures meet. Summarizing the meeting of the English and the Indians in Virginia, Professor Fowles.
When the two peoples could get away from that inevitable ideological issue of whether they believed in the right or the wrong God, whether they wore moccasins or shoes, or how they dressed, or how they treated their wives, or how they lived, when they could just meet each other, communicate in terms of friendship, and have one go away satisfied with a copper bracelet and have the other go satisfied with a beaver pelt, that was all the better. But Virginia, thanks to the company and thanks to the English population and thanks especially to the English clergymen, always had to stress the most divisive elements, the lack of Christianity, the lack of civilization on the part of the Indians. And I think that really boils down to precipitating a fatal confrontation and clash of the cultures.
As It Was in the Beginning was written by Elizabeth Carlson, produced by Ralph Johnson, with technical production by Marv Nunn. Chief Academic Advisor for Sound Studies in American History is Professor Thomas J. Archdeacon of the History Department at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Sound Studies in American History is a production of WHA Radio, University of Wisconsin Extension.